Thank you, Joe. I'm Dave Cohen, WWL First News. Now back to Tommy Tucker on WWL.
I'm going to put you ahead of the line here. Dave, you got any questions about cryptocurrency?
No, none at all.
Do you have any interest in investing in it?
No, none at all.
Me neither. Absolutely not. Stock market's bad enough for me. I don't need to deal with cryptocurrencies, but I'll tell you who's going to explain it to us is Ryan Peters, finance professor at Tulane's A.B. Freeman School of Business. Teaches a course on financial technology and blockchains. We talked earlier, last week I think it was, but we're going to pretend like we never talked, Professor, because I don't know how many people would remember that or not. So let's start all over, all right?
Works for me, and thanks for the friendly intro.
Thank you, sir. It's true. How many cryptocurrencies are there?
Okay. I like to make a distinction between cryptocurrencies and digital assets, right? So
okay.
Cryptocurrencies, I'm not super fond of the nomenclature, honestly, but I sort of get it.
Take me from the get-go, because I don't understand what you're saying there. Why not?
There's a cryptographically secured blockchain, right? Crypto lives on blockchains.
You're asking me, right? Sure, Professor, whatever you say.
Sure. There is.
Crypto what?
There's a cryptographically secured blockchain like Bitcoin, and it has a native token on it. That's the Bitcoin token, and so it's useful to make a distinction between the Bitcoin blockchain and the Bitcoin token.
But let me jump in for a second. There is no actual token. This is just a picture, right?
It's not a picture. The Bitcoin blockchain is a ledger that maintains balances of an asset, and the thing we call that asset on the Bitcoin blockchain is Bitcoin.
So token would be the unit of measure?
Yes. So okay. One Bitcoin, one token. But you can break those things into, you know, unreasonably small quantities. And so one, you know, 10 to the 12th or 16th or something of a Bitcoin as the smallest unit. But you can have one Bitcoin, the token that lives on the blockchain. And that's what we call the cryptocurrency, right? So I don't love currency because currency makes it sound like money, and I don't, you know, whether it's money or not is questionable. It's an asset that you can own on the blockchain. But you also have lots of non-native assets, right? So Bitcoin is the native asset of the Bitcoin blockchain. The only thing Bitcoin blockchain does is keep track of ownership of Bitcoin's, you know, the token. But you can also have assets issued on blockchains that are not the native currency. They're just somebody stands up a new ledger for a new asset, right? And those can come in tons of different flavors. Some of them are trying to be money, and some of them aren't. How's
okay.
that?
let's go back to cash. So we got cash, and then somebody decided that, you know what, why don't we do this online? Why don't we do this digitally, right? Instead of exchanging money or currency electronically, Professor, you got to hang in with me. I'm telling you right now, it's going to be a long hour for you. We had currency and we would just be wire transfers of dollars, although the dollars didn't actually move, right?
Right. So the dollars don't, if you're just thinking about physical bills, we got away from that system a long, long time ago, right? I mean, the 1700s or something, used to print physical bills for all of the dollars. And for a long time, they were backed by gold up until Nixon, you know, ended the gold standard in the 70s. But a long time ago, we went to a sort of ledger system where you actually keep your money in banks, right? And the bank doesn't have a physical dollar bill for every dollar you have in it. What the bank has is a ledger that says, you know, we owe Tommy X number of dollars, even though we don't have those dollars sitting in some Scrooge McDucky vault somewhere, right?
I like that. Keep going.
Well, and so the move from what we now call like digital, right? You can think of like PayPal or Zelle or some payment system is actually just something that lives on top of the old banking system. It's a way to send messages about balances rather than to move physical dollars, because those physical dollars don't and haven't for a long time existed. Some single digit percent of currency of dollars is actually currency in circulation, right? And so that's where the currency is the physical dollar. But the money mostly just lives on ledgers in banks and then is ultimately settled up on ledger balances at the Federal Reserve.
But it is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, so
usually
you know,
backed by gold, and then one day they said, "No, there's no more gold backing it," and now it's just faith and credit.
Because really, what are you going to do with gold anyway? I never understand that. How did gold become such a? Because it's precious, you can't eat it, right? Pretty
soft
metal.
Yeah, I don't know. The way I teach my class actually is I like to start with coinage as the first financial technology, right? So this comes out of sort of ancient Greece.
Right.
The standardization of a unit of exchange is actually this really nice financial technology. So you can say, I can identify the value of that coin. And originally, the first coins were made of electrum, which is a combination of gold and silver for today's history lesson, I guess.
Well, that's what you hear. You're here to teach us. So for whatever reason, it was made of a precious metal, so that was what they made the unit of exchange, and then it went to paper money, and then from there it went to ledger balances. Am I accurate so far? Did I hurt myself?
Yeah, no. Paper money actually started as demand deposits on gold, right? Something written down on paper was just you had the right to claim some gold at some window at some point in the future, and it's just a lot easier to carry around a piece of paper than it is to carry around physical gold.
So so we went to it being on ledgers and banks, no bills actually existing. So tell me about crypto. Who started this and how old is it? And it would seem as though it's only a unit of exchange as long as the other person accepts it. Yes or no?
Yes. No, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, you can distinguish between Bitcoin, right, which has its own value. It floats around, happens to be high today. It has been low at times, and nobody's going to claim that that's a particularly good unit of account, right? You never know what Bitcoin is going to be worth in dollar terms tomorrow. You can also think about something like Circle's USDC. So the Circle company just went public a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, I don't know. And the product they sell is a digital asset, right, a token that lives on a blockchain that is backed by dollars, right? So a USDC, a US dollar coin, is worth about a dollar. And so you can exchange that on a blockchain rather than going through, you know, something like Zelle or PayPal. PayPal also actually has
easy. My eyes are glazing over again,
digital asset currency.
My eyes are glazing over again, Professor. Hang on a second. So how do somebody texted in, let me jump to this for a second, and said, you may want to think twice about not investing in crypto. I've pretty much been doubling my money every year for the past couple of years with Bitcoin. Is he doubling his money or she doubling their money or doubling their Bitcoin? And how do I get Bitcoin into the Federal Reserve or ledger and banks, ledgers, banks, things?
So there are banks now that can custody Bitcoin and other digital assets. Bank of New York Mellon, I think, actually has like a Bitcoin custody sort of line of business that they're willing to do.
So what does that mean, custody? They'll give it real value?
No, they don't value it. What they'll do is hold it for you, right? So one of the most burdensome parts of owning cryptocurrency is actual custody. We're used to banks where you say you deposit your money in a bank, and if the bank, I don't know, lends money against it to a company or, you know, to finance somebody's house for a mortgage or something, and the bank loses the money, the banking system is backed by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, right? And so the FDIC is standing behind the banks saying your money's good, even if the bank, even if the financial institution to which you've given your dollars loses it somehow, right? Banks go under all the time and are, you know, then dealt with through the FDIC system or the Federal Reserve if they're the really big banks and it's the financial crisis or something. Cryptocurrency is not like that. You kind of have to hold your own or trust somebody else to hold it for you. And holding it on your own means maintaining your private keys to those assets to move them around on a blockchain. And so for a lot of people, it's very nice to not have to maintain those those private keys, that particular number or phrase that unlocks those tokens to give them to somebody else. And so cryptocurrency exchanges provide this service, but now traditional banking and financial systems, institutions are starting to get into this business of actually custodying the assets, putting them on their own ledger and backing them by their own, you know, credit or faith, that kind of thing.
Somebody wants to know about, and we're going to have to do this in a nonlinear manner because I want to work the listeners in. Ask him about XRP, XIM, and Cardano crypto. I hope I didn't say anything dirty there by accident.
I've heard of two of those. XRP is Ripple. They're trying to do interbank and international payments, though I can't claim to know that much about them. Cardano's a smart contract chain. I don't have deep things. The other one I've never heard of. I don't know what it is.
All right. So somebody else texted in and said, where does the money go at the end of the purchase of crypto? Who gets the money? Because at some point, people are buying crypto with dollars, right?
Well, whoever's selling them the cryptocurrencies ends up with those dollars. These things are actively traded, not unlike stocks, right? You spend money on a stock, and who gets the money? Well, if it's a primary issue, the company that issued the stock gets the money, and if it's on secondary markets, then whoever owned the stocks that sold it to you gets the money. Not dissimilarly with crypto, you can purchase tokens from an issuer, or you can purchase them on the secondary market. If you're purchasing them on the secondary market, then whoever sold it to you got the money. So certainly, you know, the guy who's doubling his money, I assume that means dollars every year with Bitcoin. If you look at the price history of Bitcoin, it has indeed gone up over time dramatically. I mean, this is an asset that was worth, you know, less than a dollar 15 years ago and is currently priced, I don't know, somewhere around 110, 120.
How much does it fluctuate, Professor Bitcoin? If I were to look at this as a whatever chart, a bar graph, whatever it is, I don't know.
Yeah, I would say the volatility of individual digital assets like Bitcoin is probably about or slightly more volatile than the prices of, call it, small caps in equities, right? Mm-hmm. Very volatile things. And as finance professors, when anybody asks us about, you know, how should my portfolio look, the canned answer that's pretty good, honestly, is you should be invested in low-load diversified ETFs or mutual funds, right? Mm-hmm. You should be looking to avoid the idiosyncratic risk of having a large portion of your portfolio in any particular, you know, traditionally we think about stocks, but any asset, right? And so the same reason you want to not have, you know, some large percentage of your portfolio in a single highly risky, you know, small cap stock is the same reason you would not maybe want to put a large portion of your portfolio into a single risky digital asset if you're thinking about sort of volatility. Now, if you have perspective on the future value of those of that particular company, stock, you know, national bond issue, whatever, then, you know, that's risk, that's investment, and you should be compensated for that in the long run, right? Bearing risk should pay something.
But when I buy a stock, I'm investing in a company, right? And if the company goes belly up, okay, I lost my investment. But the company, generally speaking, manufactures something or provides a service, and that's what Bitcoin or crypto is doing?
So the variety of digital assets, some of which look like, you know, like Circle's USDC, which is just a dollar in a bank somewhere or invested in U.S. Treasuries sitting somewhere in a Circle account saying we are willing to redeem all of the USDC coins for a dollar. Some look more like equity in something, right? And so there are definitely companies that rather than issuing traditional equity shares, issue a token and say, this is going to receive the cash flows from our operations. These are usually, you know, more crypto native type companies.
So wait, now it seems like we're knocking on the door of a pyramid scheme here.
There are definitely a lot of those in crypto, for sure.
Let me take a break, Professor. We'll pick it up right now. We'll let our eyes deglaze, okay? Because it's complicated stuff. It really is. And I think one big question, I'm getting this a lot from the text line when it comes to cryptocurrency, and it's pretty simple. Three letters. Why? Why are we even doing this? I don't know. I don't get it. And I'm not a dumb guy, I don't think. I'm not an old guy. It just seems like the Beanie Baby model where someone's going to get stuck holding these things because it has no intrinsic value. Ryan Peters, finance professor at Tulane's A.B. Freeman School of Business, nor backed by anything, I don't think. Maybe it is. Teaches a course on financial technology and blockchains. We're spending the hour talking about cryptocurrency. If you know all about it, congrats. But if not, you can text your questions in on the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and text line at 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along. When we come back, Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 9:30. First of all, thanks to Professor Ryan Peters for suffering this fool gladly, because I think he's at the point with me where some people are when they need computer help and the other person says, just stop pressing buttons. Just put it down. Finance professor at Tulane's A.B. Freeman School of Business, teaches a course on financial technology and blockchains. We're talking about cryptocurrency and blockchains. Professor, I'm getting a lot of text here, and it's the questions at the top of my mind, and it's why? What's the end game here? What are we trying to do?
All right. Well, first off, I like this, Tommy. I'm having a good time.
Good. I'm glad you are. Second. I am too.
Second, the way I think about a blockchain is it's.
I'm glad you enjoyed dangling the string in front of the cat. That's nice. That's great. I'm glad you're having a good time, Professor. I'm just playing. Go ahead, please.
The way I think about blockchains is they're bank back-end technology, right? And so we don't usually think about what's going on, you know, Citibank or J.P. Morgan Chase's back-end services.
What are those?
And yet, you know, they have servers somewhere keeping track of the ledgers.
Oh, servers. I thought you said services. I didn't know what that was.
Okay. The servers provide the services, right?
Okay.
That's the back end of the bank. The blockchain acts as an alternative to bank back-end software and servers.
Okay, but wait, hang on a second. Banks are backed by the FDIC, right?
Well, so that's the dollars, yeah. But, yeah, like, the actual transfers of the money, right? There are fun stories about financial services, usually non-bank financial services, mm-hmm, where the company goes out of business and they turn the servers off, and now nobody knows where the dollars are. Banks are very, very highly regulated by the U.S. government, so that can never happen, and it hasn't happened yet to an actual FDIC-backed bank. But that's how I think about a blockchain. It's bank back-end software. The idea behind the first sort of successful cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, was, can we have a thing, value it how you want, right? Price high, price low, doesn't matter. Can we have a thing, a token, that you can transfer to another person without a financial intermediary, where you hold the asset and you can send it directly to somebody else over the internet, right? Value transfer by email without having a bank or any other financial institution standing in the middle of that transaction. That's the innovation that Bitcoin sort of was, right? Where we can transfer value over the internet without a financial intermediary. There's no bank standing in the middle. Today, lots of things have been built on that idea. Bitcoin is still there. You can value Bitcoin however you want. And at the end of the day, the value of a thing is a function of supply and demand and the present discounted value of future cash flows, right? Like you were talking about, the intrinsic value, the backing. What's it going to get if you hold it? So a thing like, I like using stable coins as an example, because there you're not thinking about the price, right? One USDC, one US dollar coin issued by Circle, now a publicly traded, you know, regulated U.S. financial institution, essentially, is just worth a dollar. That's all it is. So why would you hold that coin, and why are there, I don't know, 50 billion, 100 billion, something, in circulation of this coin that lives on a blockchain that is just worth a dollar? It is very clearly not for speculative purposes. Well, you can transfer that coin, the ownership of that claim on dollars, instantaneously, essentially, and for free over the internet. So think of this as a product that competes with, for example, Visa, right? Mm-hmm. The Visa network is for transferring dollars. You want to buy a thing, you have a credit card, you swipe your card, use the chip, whatever. You transfer dollars to the merchant. Visa takes, you know, a cut of that, and 2-3%, something like that, right? So that is the cost to the merchant of the payment system that they're using. If you're paying with USDC, the value transfer happens instantaneously and essentially for free. All you have to do is pay for that network transaction, to pay for the use of that bank backend software.
You being the customer or the business, or depends on the situation?
In retail payments, the business mm-hmm. usually pays the, unless you go, it's a new thing, restaurants will charge you like a 3% sort of, you use the credit card fee. Mm-hmm. And so that is the restaurant trying to transfer that payments cost to the customer. But generally, you know, retail payments in the U.S. cost 2-3%, something like that. Maybe a little more if it's an American Express, a little less if it's a debit card, but that's sort of the order of magnitude you should be thinking about. And so the idea of having a token that lives on a blockchain that you can transfer essentially for free can, you know, possibly reduce the expense of payments to merchants, something like that.
So who accepts what do we call it, a cryptocurrency? What do you call it, blockchain? Whatever, I don't know what to call it.
Digital assets is my preferred.
Digital assets. Let's go with that. Who accepts digital assets? Can you? If I'm going to build a house, can I say, okay, look, I got 300,000 digital assets here. Let's go.
I mean, probably not. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, the blockchain has only been around for 15 years, right? The Bitcoin blockchain. Mm-hmm. These services that live on top of blockchains, like stablecoins, are even newer, though. Acceptance of these things is expanding. Mm-hmm. And so even like PayPal's been around since 1999, started off, you know, providing payment services for eBay, if anybody remembers eBay, and has grown into its own sort of, you know, financial payments network, is issuing their token, and it's a dollar, it's a stable coin, right? It's worth $1. It's the ticker is PYUSD on a blockchain. And so you can now hold that, say you trust PayPal more than Circle or some other stablecoin issuer, and you're okay holding your dollars in PayPal, which people do, then you can now transfer that token for very low cost.
So why does Bitcoin go up and down? Why did somebody say they doubled their money with Bitcoin?
Supply and demand. So what I don't like to talk about is the prices of digital assets or cryptocurrencies, because I can't explain them any better than anybody else.
Oh, well, there you go. So there's nothing really driving it other than what any person is willing to pay for it.
Supply and demand, certainly the first order driver of lots of these things. So recently,
correct me if I'm wrong, would it be unlike a Beanie Baby where it's worth whatever any old fool is willing to pay?
I would not say it is dissimilar from that. At the end of the day, markets are supply and demand driven on prices. Mm-hmm. Recently, we've had a number of digital asset treasury companies. These are usually publicly traded companies. You can think of like MicroStrategy. There have been a number of SPAC launches, a number of publicly traded companies converting themselves into digital asset treasury companies who are explicitly trying to acquire as much Bitcoin as possible. Michael Saylor, the CEO of MicroStrategy, has been at this for years, and now there are a lot of companies copying this model. And so if you have a lot of people with a lot of dollars trying to get their hands on an asset, the price is going to go up. That's just supply and demand.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. One thing I would like you to address is what advantage do I get from engaging in digital assets as opposed to just keeping in something that I know and trust? We're talking to Ryan Peters, a finance professor at Tulane's A.B. Freeman School of Business, teaches a course on financial technology and blockchains, trying to understand digital assets. A lot of people are texting in saying, I don't want any part of it. And I don't think I do either, but that maybe we're of a different generation. I don't know. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:45, quarter till 10, talking to Ryan Peters, finance professor, Tulane's prestigious A.B. Freeman School of Business, about digital assets. Couple of texts coming in, Professor. One says, good morning. I've listened to this interview in its entirety, and this sounds like the biggest scam, even bigger than a Beanie Baby. I'm not young, but I'm not also old. I think I would rather just hide some cash under my bed mattress and have more confidence than this shady endeavor. In the long run, if it's supply and demand driving the price up, what is causing the demand for Bitcoin? Is there a limited number of Bitcoins, or is there an endless supply of a service or product, and what can it be exchanged for?
So Bitcoin does have a supply cap. There are 21 million Bitcoins scheduled for, you know, production between now and it's like 2140 or something.
But what does that mean, scheduled for production? It's just...
Yeah, so there are at least half a dozen publicly traded Bitcoin miners. This is actually
a
huge industry.
There we go. Tim was in here just now, Professor, talking to me about mining, and I told him he's talking in circles. I have no earthly idea what that's about. Explain that to me, please.
I'm happy to explain Bitcoin mining. So the way the Bitcoin blockchain works is one Bitcoin block, and a block is 1 megabyte of storage space that represents the transactions that have happened in between those blocks in those 10 minutes. Those blocks get posted to the blockchain. The block producer is paid a fee. So the first transaction in every Bitcoin block is a fee that gets paid in Bitcoin to the miner that mined that block. And so today that fee is, I think it's 3 1/8 Bitcoin. So something like $400,000.
So what am I mining again? What am I looking for if I'm going to do this? What do I do?
So the way of thinking about mining is there's a needle in a haystack. And there are millions of computers around the world trying to find that needle. The first one that finds it gets the block reward.
The needle that they're looking for?
That's where the cryptography part comes in, and I don't think you want to talk about that one, Tommy.
Well, I'm sitting down. Give me a little taste of it. Let's see.
So the way people like to say is you're trying to solve a hard math problem.
That's what he told me, and I still didn't get it. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, now you're into hash functions and leading zeros and things like that.
Keep it on an eighth grade level, please.
So there are lots of computers chugging along all day, every day, trying to find a number that solves the next block. And so that solution is a hash that is below some threshold, blah, 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 mathy stuff. There's a hard-to-find number, and millions of computers around the world trying to find it. The first time anyone finds that number, a block is produced. And so the one who found the number that solves the math problem gets, you know, today somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000, and that happens every 10 minutes. And so every 10 minutes for the next few years, 3.125 or whatever bitcoins will be mined. And then there's a halving every 4 years. So every 4 years, that number falls in half. This started at 50 for the first 4 years of the Bitcoin blockchain. The math problems were easier to solve and paid more. And as time goes on, those math problems get harder to solve as more computers join the network and try to find the needle in the haystack, and the block rewards go down so that, you know, the supply coming onto the market of Bitcoin is decreasing over time, and then eventually goes to zero in 21 something.
All right, let me go back a ways. Jimmy Stewart and the other guy are in the bank, and they got $2 left, and they close the bank, and it's a wonderful life. No, I'm just kidding. Somebody wants to know, if you have time, can you ask if there is any danger of this becoming the standard, and those of us that don't want to use it will be forced to adapt? That's an excellent question.
I think blockchains will come to represent a larger portion of financial services back-end activity. Not that people will be forced to do anything, but sort of the next iteration of PayPal will be, currently PayPal is mostly not blockchain, but a little bit of blockchain. And I think over time, the fraction that goes to blockchain will increase. JP Morgan's working on blockchains. Citibank's working on blockchains. They see this as bank back office software. And so I think more and more financial services will be powered by a blockchain back end without necessarily changing the consumer facing experience that people see.
Is there a chance that somebody gets hold, the bottom falls out and somebody gets holding the crypto a la the Beanie Babies?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not gonna say the price is going to go up. That's not.
All right. And let me ask you another question. Remember the Twilight episode, To Serve Man? It's a cookbook. When it comes to this, is this really serving humanity any, or is this helping anybody, or is it just a money-raising scam scheme, whatever you want to call it, strategy?
So the thing about blockchains is that they are permissionless. Anyone can do a thing on a blockchain. There's no, you don't have to register usually. I mean, there are laws, but those laws don't touch blockchain very much. So the amount of scams that happen on blockchains is relatively high, right? At the same time, I don't like it. It's bank backend software, so it's going to keep working, and it's going to keep being in the back, and that part's going to grow because it's secure bank backend software that is interoperable between financial services across national borders. In terms of the price, that's a different story. The price can and probably will go down at some point.
All right, let me ask you this then, real quick before we let you go. If you make money on Bitcoin, is it eventually going to be at the expense of somebody else, or is that necessarily wrong? Is that the way markets work?
This is how markets work. Okay. If you bought Amazon a long time ago and the price went up a lot, and then you sold it and you had more dollars, did you make it at somebody else's expense? Not really.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy a thing low with inside information and then sell it high before the team behind the digital asset token, you know, closes shop because you knew a bunch of stuff, then, you know, you should probably get looked at by the SEC for insider trading.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the rules there are any different than the rules in the stock market, or shouldn't be at any level.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. I really do.
Yeah, it was really fun, Tommy.
Well,
thanks.
I hope you come back, because the Lord knows we've not answered all the questions. Ryan Peters, finance professor, Tulane's A.B. Freeman School of Business. I hope we help clear some of that up. I know I want nothing to do with any of this. This, to me, sounds like nothing but a giant scam, and somebody's going to get stuck holding the Beanie Babies. And when the Beanie Babies were the fad, I said somebody's going to get stuck holding these things, because little Debbie the Dinosaur, whatever the hell it was that they were selling for, people lining up days ahead to buy for $200. I said, you know, that's got no intrinsic value. Eventually, the demand's going to go away and nobody's going to care. And guess what? People got stuck holding the Beanie Babies. We'll be back, WWL.